I'm Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen. This podcast has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri in for Jane Lindholm. Driving around New England, you can find telltale signs of the region's rich industrial past. In Manchester, New Hampshire, the old mills have been refurbished and repurposed. In Springfield, Vermont, the hulking buildings that once were productive manufacturing plants sit silent. And at Greenbanks Hollow in South Danville, Vermont, way off the beaten path, you can find the footprint of what once was a five-story woolen mill, which makes one wonder about the people who worked in these mills, how they came to these places, how they were treated, and what kind of lives they led. Our guests today have set about answering those questions, and those answers now take the form of a play called Mill Girls. It looks at the young women who worked in the mills in towns like Winooski and Lowell, Mass. Free performances of the play at the McCarthy Arts Center Theater on St. Michael's College campus in Colchester begin next Thursday, November 2nd. Here to tell us about this play and to explore the history that inspired it are Peter Harrigan, a theater professor at St. Michael's and the play's co-writer, director, and costume designer; Susan Ouellette, a professor of American Studies and History at St. Mike's. She provided the historical research for the play; and Tom Cleary, who co-wrote the play and composed and arranged the music. I want to thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Peter, give us a quick overview of what we'll experience when we see this play.
What I've done, Rick, is to take primary source materials from the early 19th century, things like letters, journal entries, news reporting, legislative testimony, and tried to piece them together in a way so that it tells a meaningful story, but mostly using the women's own words.
And you took a sabbatical to work on this play. What intrigued you about this subject at that time?
I've always been fascinated by the buildings themselves just because, as you said, we see them in our daily lives in New England. And I started to become interested in hearing some of the stories and trying to reconnect with the people who actually worked in these mills and the circumstances of their lives.
Did you have mill girls in mind at that point, or did something in the research inspire you to write the play?
I actually was thinking that the production would be much more locally based, that it would be exclusively about the history of the mills along the Winooski River. And I found some fascinating stories from the periods that the mills were open, sort of ending in the 1950s. But I wasn't finding a sort of critical mass of material or a story arc that was jumping out to me as a story that really needed to be told on stage. And when I consulted with my colleague, Susan Ouellette, who's here, she talked to me about the Lowell Mill Girls and the sort of unique moment in history that was, a sort of utopian industrial finishing school that existed for a period of time in Lowell until the mill barons, who had been sort of philanthropic to start with in order to get the girls to come and work for them, became kind of greedy and abusive.
Well, let's go to Susan Ouellette. Tell us about the Lowell and why that was like a special place and what really kind of inspires you to look into that time and place?
Well, first of all, Lowell, it was an experiment. And the Boston Associates, who created Lowell, literally created this industrial center. And there were two things going on. One is they wanted to create a profitable business, of course. But secondly, they wanted to avoid the wretched conditions that existed in mills in England. And so their ideal was that they could create these more humane places for people to work. And with their emphasis on making money, they began to look around and try to find the ideal employees. And for early 19th century America, for a lot more of that time, women were the least expensive employees. There was also this sense, because textiles are really the first area that become industrialized, and or the first product that becomes industrialized. And so since before that time, women and girls were making cloth in their homes, there was this sense that, well, if cloth is being made in factories, then these people don't have anything to do in their homes. So therefore, that makes them ideal candidates for labor in the factories.
Well, tell us what these factory owners did to make these factories a better place for women to come to.
Well, first of all, they created conditions that would make the parents of these girls allow them to come. So they created boarding houses that were specifically designed to provide room and board in a safe environment for their daughters. And then the employers also emphasized things like extracurricular and educational activities for the girls when they weren't working. So this was a huge attraction, especially for rural families whose daughters would never have an opportunity to earn money, real wages, and then also to have these cultural and social experiences beyond the farm. So it's a big attraction. And I think at first they imagined these industrial utopias where everyone would be happily going to work and happily going home and having all these experiences. And there was not a sense that these girls would go to work and work forever. They were going to just work long enough to amass a little nest egg, go home, get married, and make room for the next generation, so to speak.
And Susan, you said that these experiences were offered in Lowell, Mass. Did this idea, this concept, spread throughout New England? Were there other places this was happening?
Absolutely. It really becomes known as the American system. And Winooski is an exact reflection of Lowell in the sense that I was just talking about, that they had boarding houses, the owners of the mills were very much engaged in doing the same sorts of things. And so you can look in the newspapers, for instance, and the Daily Free Press will advertise, you know, the most recent set of speakers that were brought in to illuminate and engage the girls.
And some of those speakers were pretty impressive, right?
Absolutely. William Lloyd Garrison, one of the major abolitionists of the period. Henry Ward Beecher, a really famous Second Great Awakening minister who was well-beloved, and a variety of other activities that just were intended to really uplift and culturally enrich these young women.
Peter, the characters that you have in Mill Girls, how did you create them?
Well, four of them are actually drawn directly from actual people. In two cases, there were women, Lucy Larcom and Harriet Hanson Robinson, who wrote full-length memoirs about their experiences in the mills. In another case, there's a woman named Sarah Bagley, who wrote for the Lowell Offering, which was a literary magazine that the industrialists produced, you know, including the fiction and nonfiction writing of many of the operatives. And eventually she also wrote for another more edgy publication called The Voice of Industry, which was really more of a protest magazine, sort of pushing back against the system. She actually went on after the mills to become the nation's first female telegraph operator. So she was a pioneer in other respects as well. The fourth character that is based from an actual person is someone named Delia Page, who was from New Hampshire. And we have a collection of letters that Delia received when she was at Lowell, which somehow found their way to a library. But we don't know what Delia said in all of that. Delia doesn't have a voice in that. The most notable part of the letters involve her family, particularly her father, discouraging her from getting involved with a certain man because they believe him to be a ruffian. And I pulled out these pieces and I showed them to Tom as part of our collaboration, and he was able to find a song called The Blacksmith, which is about a young woman who falls for the wrong man, in this case a blacksmith, and it really gave voice to Delia in a way that I hadn't pictured.
And you also have composite characters, correct?
Yes. Yeah, there are a total of seven named mill girls and then two female actors who portray a number of different roles and then five male actors who are also multiply cast.
Let's take a call from Silas, who's calling from Georgia. Silas, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. What's your question?
Yes, it's basically just a comment. My mom is 98, going to be 99 right off. And she was one of the ladies that worked at the mill, her and my dad. My dad would work the first shift. She'd work the second shift. My two sisters would meet them at the fence where they came out, and they would switch. And they did this for years. My two sisters were grown up from families swapping from first and second shifts. And, you know, she still lives by herself. What a unique people they were back then. Not just my mother. Such hard workers and didn't get paid very well. And she had such great stories about how it was back then. I just thought somebody should always try to look up people like her. And maybe, you're doing this at St. Mike's, and she lives in Nelson, Vermont. It would be a nice thing to maybe research some of that history in Vermont.
Silas, thanks so much for that. Well, let me ask you, Peter. I know that Silas's family obviously would have been long after this play is set in the 1800s. But were you able to or did you talk to anyone who worked in some of the mills in these textile towns in New England as you did the research for this play?
Anecdotally, I've had contact with a lot of people just because, like Silas did, they present themselves if I'm talking about the subject. But since I was looking at a much earlier period, really kind of 1826 to the dawn of the Civil War, unfortunately, we don't have survivors in that case.
Tom Cleary, you composed the music for the play. So how evocative is it of that time period of the 1800s?
I hope it is evocative. I was working with a number of different historical sources, including hymns, because obviously we don't have recordings from this era. So you have to go with sheet music. And so I was looking in hymn books. I was scouring the wonderful Library of Congress website with the help of actually some traditional music friends. My friend Brian Perkins helped me locate a couple of things. So I was looking up hymns. I was looking up sheet music for popular songs. And then I did go into the British folk music tradition some and imagined some of those songs traveling to Lowell with the girls.
Well, let's hear one of your songs. This is Factory Girl.
She told of her long days of work at the factory, how machines nearly made the girls deaf from the sound, how the windows stayed closed even in the hot summer, how the hours went up and the wages went down. But the girls in the evening would gather to study. They would not let the mills leave them tired and cross. They had hoped there could be better working conditions, that together they'd strike a fair deal with the boss.
So, Tom, how do you use music to tell the story of these women in these mills?
Well, that song we were just listening to is a very common, or it's a well-known British folk song, and like a lot of folk songs, it has many versions where the plot goes a number of different ways, and sometimes it ends up with this guy who meets a factory girl, and they end up happily ever after. In a number of versions, she goes away or dies. And so I ended up coming up with my own ending to the song, where it's set in Lowell, it involves the girls and talks about her relationship with them as well as with him.
Peter, at what point did you say, okay, I've got this idea for Mill Girls. This is a play that needs an original score that Tom Cleary or someone needs to write?
Before I started, really, Tom and I have known each other for 20 years. But the last time we worked together directly on a show was in the year 2000. And we would run into each other at least once a year. And one or the other of us would say, hey, we should work on something together. And I've sort of had that in the back of my mind for a long time. When I had a sense that I would be creating something from scratch, as you know, that this project turned out to be, back in 2015, I said to Tom, what do you think? You know, would you be available and interested to work on this in 2016 and then produce it in the fall of 2017? And at that point, it was just a mill play. We didn't really know specifically what it was, but Tom was game. And it's been such a blessing to have his musical mind and his sense of theatricality as part of this project.
So what kind of direction did you give Tom to create this score?
I sent him a bunch of stuff. You know, we were really working pretty much independently. I was sitting on my porch in Shelburne and digging through research materials and occasionally, you know, scanning a poem and sending it to Tom or saying, oh, look, they're mentioning a song here, I Won't Be a Nun. Could you see if you can dig that up? And I would send them off to him.
How fun was this for you, Tom?
It was a lot of fun, especially because my day job is being a jazz educator at UVM. I teach in the jazz studies program and spend a lot of time looking at songs that are built on other songs. And so that happens in a number of places in this show, that we have hymns that use the same meter, or in the case of a song called I Cannot Be a Slave, a song where the original lyrics are dispensed with and somebody comes up with lyrics that relate more to the present situation.
I'm Rick Singeri, and this is Vermont Edition. Today on the show, we're talking with the creative forces of a new play at St. Michael's College. It's called Mill Girls, a story of the women working in the textile mills in Winooski and across New England. It also explores the history of America's earliest factories, its rapid industrialization, and the cultural shifts like workers' rights and abolitionist rejection of slavery in the years leading to the Civil War. With us today are St. Michael's Theater professor Peter Harrigan, the show's co-writer, director, and costume designer, Mill Girls co-writer and music composer and arranger Tom Cleary, and historian Susan Ouellet, who provided the historical backbone for the play. Susan, you said that these mills that you kind of looked at in Lowell and Winooski and other places started out with a great idea, and they provided a lot of extra opportunities for the women who came and worked there. But how did the working conditions change over time in these mills?
Well, I think that, first of all, we have to understand that since it's not just new for the girls, it's new for the employers too. So industrialization itself was just beginning. And employers were feeling their way along. They knew they wanted to make money. They knew that they wanted to engage mechanization and so on. But they didn't exactly know how that was going to turn out. So when they first opened the mills, they did probably what was most logical, which was to assign a girl to a loom or a spinning jenny or whatever equipment that they wanted her to run. And pretty quickly, they figured out that the girls could get good at it and, in fact, seemed to be sort of wasting their time going to the girls' room or having a plant on the windowsill or something, or talking too much to their neighbor. And so to maximize their value, they started to do what the girls began to refer to as stretch outs. And so they would literally give employees more machines to take care of. So at the height of this, girls were actually responsible for operating as many as 7 to 10 machines at once. And that's what stretch out really means. You were running back and forth, making sure that if you were a loom operator, for instance, making sure that all the threads were there and tight and all of the shuttles were filled and so on. Then another method for getting more out of your employees, because you're paying them by the hour, you're not paying them for what they're producing, is to literally speed the machines up. These are all, you know, they're running off of the mechanical power of the water. So you can make them run faster by gearing them up. And so they would speed up. And what happened is these girls who in the evenings would be sitting together in the boarding houses would talk about, you know, oh, I've been given another machine, or my machine is running faster. And they began to think about and talk about the fact that they were really experiencing exploitation. They might not have used that word directly, but certainly that's what they
believed. They came to the realization that they were being exploited?
Absolutely.
Let's take a call from Brian. He's calling from Montreal. Brian, thanks for joining us today on Vermont Edition. Go right ahead.
Well, thanks for taking me. Susan, I don't know if you're aware, but your family name is really common here in Quebec, and that's partly what I wanted to raise. A lot of Quebec's mythic history of the 19th century talks about the numbers of Quebecers, French-speaking Quebecers, with names like Ouellette, who went down to the United States, North New England specifically, because there was no work for women here on the farms of Quebec, or not enough work, because our farms are very tiny and there was no mechanization. Did your research touch on the French-Canadian immigration to those mills and the women's part in it? And I also wanted to alert you that there's also a whole musicography of the French-Canadian exile during that time. The most famous Canadian folk song from that era is called Un Canadien Errant. Un Canadien Errant, banni de ses pays, which talks specifically about the numbers of Quebecers, Canadians as they called them, who had to leave the country for all kinds of reasons.
Brian, thanks so much. Susan, go right ahead.
Oh, well, first of all, you can't live in New England in an urban industrial area without running into all of the French names that are applied to streets. Every community that had a mill had a Little Canada, and hundreds, if not thousands, of Quebecers came. Some stayed. There was a lot of back and forth. The idea was you would come, work for a while, take the money home. Some people did that. Many others didn't. At any given time, you could probably find 50% of the mill population being French Canadian. And then once the Irish immigration begins to happen, immigrants outnumber everyone else 5 to 1.
Let's take another call. Judy is calling from Winooski. Judy, thanks for calling Vermont Edition. Go right ahead.
Hi. I remember as a teenager, I'm now in my late 60s, reading a book, An American Tragedy by Theodore Dreiser, and it was about work in the mills, I believe in Massachusetts, maybe even Lowell, and the terrible hardships, and there was a terrible fire in one of the factories. And I wonder if in your research you considered what was in that book. It's quite a classic book.
Great question, Judy. Susan, again, I think this one's for you.
Well, An American Tragedy actually looks at the real-life drama of a murder that happened, and it's actually New York State where this the core of that story came from. And it's really a story of a mill girl who gets taken advantage of and then murdered by the young man who had plans for himself that didn't include marrying his pregnant mill girl girlfriend. In many ways, the story is one that really resonates for a lot of the experiences of mill girls, although that one is a little bit later in time than what we're talking about in terms of the early Winooski mills.
Peter, Susan was mentioning how, you know, these mills started out with great ideas. Eventually, things got more onerous for the people, the women working there. So in your play, Mill Girls, how do these stories of these characters reveal that change?
Well, it's an interesting sort of progression for them. They're encouraged to learn, you know, in their spare time, but the mill barons don't necessarily end up enjoying the kinds of ideas and strategies that the mill girls come up with. Things like strikes and walkouts become part of the picture. The young women form their own association called the Lowell Female Reform Association, which is really one of the first, not a union, but one of the first labor organizations in our country. And then eventually they join forces with a male labor association, and the women are officers in the organization. So it's this amazing position of power and respect that they had long before they ever gained the right to vote.
Now, this is an original play with an original score. So let's hear another song from the play. This is Web of Freedom.
Just as the strongest cloth is woven from so many disconnected strands.
Tom Cleary, you composed this score. Tell us what's being conveyed in that song.
Well, I want to just give a little shout out to that was recorded in the basement of my in-law's house, and my mother-in-law worked for many years in textile mills. So that she and uniform factories and just in the textile industry. So she was one of my sources. Remind me of the question again.
Oh, sorry. So tell us in that song what's being conveyed. That was Web of Freedom.
Right. Well, we get to the end of this time period that's discussed in the play, and the mill girls have been working on organizing themselves as laborers and also becoming more and more aware of the abolitionist movement. And so I sort of started to imagine how by looking at these looms where these, you know, threads are coming together in this particular way, that it might have been a metaphor for them in terms of how their movement and the abolitionist movement, which number of them went on to join, the way those might intersect.
So Tom, why was this project, writing a score and the subject matter of the play, why was it of interest to you?
That's a great question. I wanted to thank the caller from Canada because I'm going to add that song to – I've got a growing list of Mill Girls 2, the score to Mill Girls 2.
Plus, we rarely get a caller who will openly just sing for us.
That was fantastic.
Really, yeah, right?
Please, more people call in and sing. It's right. I was going to say also that, you know, I'm the great grandson on my mother's side and the grandson on my father's side of Irish immigrants. And so that was one of the first places I went, was to the British Isles, music of the British Isles. But to be able to bring together church music, which is one of the traditions I've been involved with for a long time, folk music, which I've always had an interest in, you know, a number of different traditions like that, and popular songs. And to be able to do some musical detective work was really, really fun.
Susan Ouellette, what can we learn from this history of that time period that might help us today?
Well, I think that the larger story here of the ability for people to develop relationships among the people that they work with that really can take positive energy forward. So these girls got together and decided they weren't going to be taken advantage of, and they supported each other. There was a walk-off. I don't know that you'd call it a strike, but there was a walk-off out of the Burlington Woolen Mill over what they felt was an unfair firing of one of their number, and they successfully convinced the employer to take that person back. So I think that collective action is something that's really positive, and we can take away from that.
I want to read a few comments we've gotten so far. Diane in Newport posted on Facebook suggesting that people take a trip to Lawrence and Lowell, Mass. And tour the mills. We heard from Dana in Fairfax. She wrote, in 1993, I worked as an interpreter at the Boot Cotton Mills Museum at Lowell National Historical Park. This show is beginning to bring back memories of the stories of Lucy Larcom, boarding houses, water turbines, and the noise of the looms. I very much look forward to seeing Mill Girls. And then we had this question from Sabra in Verscher, who asked, were the Mill Girls weaving with wool? If so, have you found any connections between this wool industry and the role that Vermont played in the Civil War?
It's interesting. One of the reasons why I chose to write more about Lowell that, you know, rather than Winooski is because of the whole wool question. Most of the wools here in Vermont, most of the mills here in Vermont produced wool, and it was from sheep in Vermont. In Lowell, they were almost exclusively producing cotton, and the young women figured out that the cotton was being picked by enslaved Africans in the South and then being processed by underpaid young women in the North. And they thought, wow, we're part of that oppressive cycle. It just really made me think about the ways we participate in and, you know, encourage oppressive cycles ourselves.
Peter, the show opens next Thursday, a week out. How close are you to being ready with the cast?
We're getting closer. It's always a little bit of a scramble, but that's part of the fun.
And this is not only a play that you wrote, but this is actually being used as a teaching tool at St. Mike's. Tell us what's being done there.
We're looking at things like the labor movement, ethics, values, corporate greed, and those kinds of things really find their way into so many classes on campus. So I'm really thrilled that other professors are using the performance as a text for their students.
And then there's an abridged version for school children.
Yes. We have short sections of the show that are actually going to be performed at the Champlain Mill as part of the Heritage Winooski Mill Museum programming. And students from St. Francis Xavier School and the Winooski Middle School will be coming down, seeing a part of the show, and then participating in lesson plans that will be led by St. Michael's College education students.
I'm going to live dangerously. Let's take one more call. Bill is calling from Wyndham. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi. I have a question that has to do with the early mills in Vermont. I'm familiar with what happened at Lowell. I'm curious whether the Vermont mills tried to replicate that, and in particular, did they have, you know, dormitories for young women? Did they try to make sure they went to church on Sunday and have a house mother to supervise their contact with young men and so on? Because I see the Lowell effort to sort of Americanize the factory system and preserve the virtue of young women.
Susan, what's
the... I'm wondering if the Vermont mills tried to do that.
Absolutely. Winooski had a boarding house. In fact, the old Peking Duck building was the boarding house for the women who worked in the Burlington Woolen Mill. And so, absolutely.
Wow. Peter Harrigan is a theater professor at St. Michael's and Mill Girls co-writer, director, and costume designer. Susan Ouellette is a professor of American Studies and History at St. Mike's. She provided the historical research for the play, and Tom Cleary co-wrote the play and composed and arranged the music. It opens next Thursday, and it's free, correct?
Yes. Yes. We advise people to come early if they can, but it's free, open seating, first come, first serve.
Thank you all for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Vermont Edition on VPR.